Right. World Watchers International originates at KLRB, Carmel, California. Here's May.
Good evening. This is May Bressel in Carmel, California. It's broadcast number 526, January 3rd, 1981. I want to apologize for losing my voice last week. That was the first time I've been on the air 11 years that I lost my voice completely, I guess about 3 minutes before the hour was over. The vocal cords just didn't connect. I had surgery on my vocal cords about 26 years ago and couldn't talk for about 3 months before and 3 months after, had speech therapy. And 2 years or 3 years before that, I had a first surgery on the vocal cords. So with that past history long behind me and using my voice constantly, I suddenly flashed, is it going to happen again? It was just, I think, from being tired and on the verge of the flu after the Christmas and Thanksgiving holidays. Things get hectic around here, just like they do in your homes. And it went away right afterwards, but the vocal cords just didn't connect. And it does happen sometimes, I suppose. One other item before we get into the news. A message went out for people who subscribe to these tape cassettes about a change in price. Disregard that notice. I have a lot of checks on my desk to take into the tape center that duplicates these tapes. And anybody who has not received a notice and has sent in checks right through 1982, some people have sent them into the spring or summer even, disregard that. Any that are paid up till now and until the future, till you get this tape, the next check that you send in, whenever it is, whether it's in March or April or May or February, the price will go up on the tapes. They're $5 a cassette. If you want a copy of the broadcast each week or to subscribe to them, or if you miss a broadcast and I hope follow them regularly, you can get those cassettes. And with those cassettes goes a printed sheet with information and the sources that I use on the program for that particular evening. I'm still indexing the broadcast last week, the series from 1981, the top stories of 1981, and when I get that completed, I'll mail that out to the regular subscribers to the program. Richard Allen is on his way out. By the time you hear this, most of you receive the cassettes. The local people know it from the news. The National Security Advisor will be out by Monday morning. He'll have a choice whether to resign or be fired. It was a mistake to make him the security advisor in the first place. It was a mistake to make William Casey the CIA director, and I'm sure that there will be rumbling in the next few months, or if they can't handle two scandals at one time, or three, because Mr. Donovan of the Labor Secretary is under investigation with a special prosecutor. Also, we can't have too many criminals leaving the ship at one time, so they might space it out. The bad news, of course, is that General Haig has the strong arm of the president. There was a conflict between Alexander Haig and Richard Allen, and Richard Allen is on his way, and I think that also Mr. Casey, Haig has firm control of the president. The Pentagon is still strong, West Point is still strong, and Allen's connections to Robert Vesco and to other espionage operations were too convoluted to investigate his past that he didn't reveal at his hearings when he was made National Security Advisor. So Alexander Haig is still in. The point of Allen's dismissal is not the fact that he had that $1,000 in his desk. He was cleared on that. There's another cover story on why he is out, and that has to do with the time that he sold his business, his public relations office. He lied about that, and he lied about it the time that he was receiving the funds. But I still believe that the most important story about Richard Allen is the meeting at Blair House on the 19th of January with Ronald Reagan, and as the Japanese newspaper said, the big gift, January 18th. I'm sure that we will never know what the big gift was. They baited that story maybe in exchange for special consideration of office automobile imports and other computer imports that we're putting on Japan, that they will break this administration if they reveal the story. They have a little bit out, but not a lot. Now, at the time all this was going on, Nancy Reagan was the excuse. Taking the picture of her was the excuse. This involved a lot more because Richard Allen never works with anything less than hundreds of thousands and up to the million. And It had nothing to do with that money in the desk. Nancy likes jewelry. She likes china and linen and clothes, but she also borrowed about $1 million worth of jewelry to wear to Prince Charles' wedding. And a patron of hers, a friend or a group that helped them get all the goodies they want, offered to donate a group of jewelers to give her jewelry, and it would sit at the Smithsonian Institute when she wasn't wearing it. The Smithsonian said, no, thank you. But I just wonder, and I think out loud, if this transaction had anything to do with Nancy. The thing that made Ronald Reagan mad was that they brought Nancy Reagan's name into it. That's what made him furious. And as I mentioned several weeks ago on this program, the luncheon that the staff had, half of Reagan's staff behind Allen, and all the biggies of the espionage establishment in Washington, D.C., the 200 or 300 or 400 people, that made Ronald Reagan furious. We always see his smiling pictures, but I read in the newspaper that that just blew his mind, and it would make me very mad, too, while somebody's under investigation, have that kind of Washington power behind this particular person. The evening news, the ABC News tonight said Allen has, in quotes, embarrassed the administration beyond the point of no return. Now, to replace him is William Clark, another interesting person. No experience in foreign policy. He was taken from the California Supreme Court into the State Department because Ronald Reagan didn't exactly, and for very good reason, trust Alexander Haig, and it was even in the news media as such, and Clark was there to watch Haig. They both got along fairly well. His appointment is a major step to eliminate friction between the White House and the cabinet members. The newspaper mentioned this, that there was this friction, and we talked about the friction in the White House from the time of the inauguration until the night before the shooting and afterwards in March of 1981 of Ronald Reagan. There was a lot of infighting, and there still is and will be, between these personalities. This new national security advisor will see the president daily. He needs input from a friend. He is like a prisoner in the Oval Office. And this is a buddy he's known for a long, long time and trusted more than Richard Allen. And so Ronald Reagan is going to have somebody that will meet with him daily, and that is the way it should be. There's no reason for him to be isolated between all these factions of the CIA, the Defense Department, the Secretary of the State, the National Security Council, and I have referred to them many times, like the story in Black Samba where the tigers are all fighting each other. This way, he will have his buddy, William P. Clark, to see him every day, his security blanket. The disadvantage of Clark being in this new position is that he was the watchdog of Haig, and now who will be Haig's watchdog? That by getting rid of Allen, we put William Clark into another position with the president, but who there will be able to watch Haig? And that's a good question. All of them spent the New Year's together down at Annenberg's home in Palm Springs. William Clark was there. And also Mr. Haig, Alexander Haig. And this is the first time that he has ever been to this kind of a social fair, socializing New Year's Eve with these people. And his picture was very evident on the front page of our story today. And it's the first time, really, I'm saving a collection of Ronald Reagan pictures, that Reagan had a very serious look. He was sitting on the sofa with Haig, and he wasn't smiling. Jack Anderson had an article in the Washington Post about a week and a half ago, Diplomacy by Generals. And he went on to say that if you hear saber rattling in the State Department, it's because Alexander Haig, the four-star general that the senators were uneasy about appointing to the State Department, have their worst fears to live up to. He's put military men in charge of diplomacy. Nowhere is the militarization of State Department more striking than the Inter-American Affairs. From the Pentagon, he's brought generals in who want to put a naval blockade around Fidel Castro, who want military action in Latin America, and he's turned retired military, Robert McFarlane, a retired military colonel, General Vernon Walters, who was the deputy director of the CIA, Lieutenant General Gordon Sumner. They're putting them all, these ultra-conservative, into the Central America desk, and the Pentagon has moved in where the State Department had a range of voices, and they've moved them out. So in a way, it's kind of cute to get Mr. Clark out of the way and let the generals and the admirals run Central America. It's really sad. William Clark was a chief of staff when Reagan was governor in California. He was the one who recruited Edwin Meese, who now is in charge of the White House staff. He's always been close to Caspar Weinberger out here, and he recruited Michael Deaver, who's deputy chief of staff and leaving after 1982. So he's very comfortable with the staff, and now the president will have William Clark next to him, and then off of that, Secretary of State Haig, Secretary of Defense Weinberger, and CIA Director William Casey. So William B. Clark is a man who came from San Luis Obispo in California. He didn't have a law degree and became a justice on the Supreme Court. He knows nothing about foreign affairs, and he'll be national security advisor. But those things don't scare me anymore, because the experts are the worst fools that we can imagine. Having these experts running our country has been a disaster. And in all the scandals and stories around California and nationally, William Clark's name really has never been muddled or muddy, at least as much as a lot of other people, even when he was on the Supreme Court. Roland Evans and Robert Novak had an article last week, "Don't Count Out Al Haig Yet. He Survives His Blunders." And there's that mean face with the jowls, and it says, "All sorts of tactical blunders he can do. He creates nagging dilemmas for the president. He exasperates the cabinet." And it goes into how he can stop a story by Jack Anderson. He can call the president at Camp David. He's a survivor. He's mean, and he's a survivor, and he runs the show. He was putting down Dick Allen at the Cancun conference in Mexico, and they were right. They said, "Don't count Haig out yet." Many people hoped that he would be forced to leave after the assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan, but it didn't work. And as I say, there's a front page picture in the Monterey Herald of Ronald Reagan, very serious this time with Al Haig, whether usually he's always happy and smiling. And the story of the replacement of Allen is one that should be finalized by next week. And also in the weeks to come, I'm going to continue on the Richard Allen links to the Beverly Hills Police, the Howard Hughes Organization, to Robert Vesco and the CIA. His criminal activities are thick. Reagan allegedly was going to offer him another job in the government. He'll be around. If a man like Richard Nixon can be a survivor, you can imagine that Richard Allen will be back. So within a few weeks, I'll continue that series that I'm going to put off one more week because of the affairs in Poland, and we'll get back to Richard Allen, I hope. Sometimes these events move so quickly, we don't get to cover them like the way I would like to. I want to talk about the Polish situation. I briefly mentioned it 2 weeks ago. I mentioned the crisis would be similar to the Iranian crisis, that we'd meet a stalemate, that America had reached its peak and was impotent, and that we are blackmailed by so many things that we've done that the Soviet Union can step in and stop the actions that we intended for in the moment. Now, in terms of blackmail, one of the blunders we do is that when we leave the embassy, such as in Vietnam or with the Pueblo, when the ship was captured by the Koreans, North Koreans, or when we have an embassy in Iran taken and the papers are left on the desk, we leave information that goes directly to the Soviet Union, and then they can take it and disseminate it around to other people to show the kind of actions we're doing. They're not just names of agents, but much of it has to be involved with political assassinations, government overthrows, with coups, with treacherous organizations like the SAVAK in Iran or DINA, the secret police in Chile. And it's those documents that we leave around were so messy that the Soviet Union can hold those over us. And in this case, I believe that in the Polish affairs, that they already have papers that they took immediately out of Polish organizations, over 400 offices or setups, that the intent of the United States and the CIA to plan a coup in Poland and kick the Soviet influence, the Soviet bloc, out. And also in Iran, they're publishing there a series of books, 11 volumes, of the American affairs in Iran and the names of our agents in the Middle East and Asia and also in Poland were received by the Iranians at the time the embassy was taken. And it involved the Warsaw Pact, the Warsaw countries, so the Soviet Union can get the names who are particular agents and know who to look for or where to come in. So they wait till we create the crisis in Iran or in Poland. Then they move in, get the documents and papers, and we can't move. It's similar to the U-2 flights at the time of the planned peace meeting in Khrushchev and Eisenhower. And Eisenhower told the CIA not to fly the spy planes over the Soviet Union. And we did, and a plane was down. And, of course, our CIA and our president and American officials said it was a weather reconnaissance plane. And we made up all kinds of lies about what it was. And the Soviet Union sat quietly while we talked about our lies. And then they produced Gary Powers in a spy plane. And it puts you in a very humiliating position to guarantee people that you're not doing such things and then to be caught in the act. I mentioned a possible stalemate, over in Poland, and I'll give you the reasons why. Incidentally, there was an interesting article this week about Ronald Reagan being interviewed in Palm Springs on the Polish situation, and the Associated Press carried a story that apparently anticipating a question on Poland, Reagan had his answers typed in capital letters on an index card. And Larry Speaks, the White House press secretary, deputy press secretary, said Ronald Reagan had generally approved of the recommendations he made or submitted to the Special Situation Group. I spoke to a friend about that Special Situation Group, and they told me that it was quite common for this kind of a discussion to get together and decide on a way to treat another country or a crisis and then present the options to the president. But that isn't entirely true. The Washington Post had an article December 17th on the Special Situation Group. It's a group that George Bush chairs. He was a director of the CIA at one time. He was the ambassador to China. And he's in charge of the Polish affair, which is practically the most important operation that the United States government can do. I think the Soviet Union knows that they'll either make us or break us at this point, because if our allies won't go along with us and they continue to buy oil and build an oil pipeline to Russia through all the European countries, it's going to be hard for us to encourage them to make war with Poland or the Soviet Union. So if George Bush has sat very quietly since the assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan, he ran for the primaries and didn't make it as president, and neither did Haig, who wanted to be president. But they're sitting there now running what is called the Special Situation Group. Now, they have debates, and they study the crisis, and then they present it to Ronald Reagan. Now, Reagan signed a directive called the Special Crisis Section. It was supposed to be a crisis section. And this is the crisis management team that caused the bitter fight between George Bush and Alexander Haig just the week prior to the assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan. March 24th, the decision was made for George Bush to head this group, and they changed it from the management crisis to the Special Situation Group. It was this group that Bush wanted to be the head of for national international affairs, and Alexander Haig wanted it. I can see why, because he was the head of NATO and could twist the wrists of his former buddies. And Haig was very out of joint 6 days before Ronald Reagan was shot, because we were going to have a very fast-moving year that was probably stalled because of that shooting, with the Polish crisis could escalate at any time. It's been building up for a while. But the Special Situation Group was just formed this year. It is clearly intended to function on similar future fast-breaking global problems, the New York Times said. So that George Bush is on the team. He was from the CIA, Secretary of State Alexander Haig, Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger, James Baker, who ran George Bush's campaign and close to John Connally from Texas, Edwin Meese III, Michael Deaver, James Nance. He's the acting national security advisor until the new appointment goes. He's an admiral, incidentally. I don't know if you knew that. He was an admiral who works for our conservative congressman from North Carolina. And William Casey of the CIA and General David Jones, chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff. So you have quite a few of the Pentagon there and a few civilians, and CIA, and George Bush chaired the first meeting December 13th on the Polish crisis. And they do the decision-making, and then they hand the choices to Ronald Reagan. The New York Times had a story this week, "Events in Poland Keep Bush Busy. Crisis Management Team Was Created." And this article says that they work 100 yards away from Ronald Reagan while Reagan is upstairs relaxing in his residence. Another article from the Washington Post says the president's key foreign policy advisors met for 1 hour in the White House last night about the Polish situation. Reagan didn't take part in the meeting. It included all his chief aides, and the gist of what was discussed would be related to the president. They tell him what went on, and the CIA and the Pentagon make all decisions. In a book that I'm going to refer to in the next few weeks and this evening more, it's called The CIA and American Labor. It describes the CIA-American foreign policy, and it says, "Americans everywhere ask, who makes foreign policy? The fact can no longer be concealed. There is a gigantic CIA paramilitary apparatus directed by men from America's largest corporations who provide Air Force, naval craft, U-2 spy planes, clandestine radio, electronic devices, thousands of analysts, research technicians to enable their government to invade lands, overthrow or install governments, incite mob actions," which they're doing in Poland right now, "and they organize massacres and assassinations. The truth is that they plot the assassinations of presidents. The CIA works with the Pentagon," and this book goes into matters such as the Bay of Pigs, the MIT Center, the U-2 overflights, the Congresses for Cultural Freedom, and the use of this particular book, the labor organizations in every country, the AFL, the CIO, when they combine, when they were separate, George Meany and Lane Kirkland, and the labor organizations who are placed in a position with the intelligence community, with the CIA and the Defense Department to cause unrest, to make sure that they control the labor organizations and the administrations in every country that they set their target on. And I have a list of their targets. Now, there was an article by Albert Shanker. He has a column. He's from the United Federation of Teachers in the New York Times this last Sunday. "Where do we stand?" And he has a comment. The world is watching to see what Reagan does about Poland. If Jimmy Carter were reelected and acted the way Ronald Reagan is acting, Reagan would be jumping all over him. The article says that there are many things he could say about Lech Walesa. He could say something about bringing the Polish situation to the United Nations. But in all likelihood, the New York Times article said, Ronald Reagan has been paralyzed in his first confrontation with the Russians. And he doesn't analyze why he's paralyzed. But Ronald Reagan did get a letter from Brezhnev. He's very quiet about it. He could have handed over any kind of information about George Bush working with John Paisley on the Soviet affairs. He could have written about George Bush's links to Orlando Letelier murder and the Salvador Allende murder in Chile. He could even be writing in a letter about the Vatican links to Solidarity and Michael Sindona and the CIA links to them, or the links of Edwin Turpel and Frank Turpel and Edwin Wilson to the assassination attempt of the Pope. And tonight's news mentioned that Mohammed Aja, the fellow who made the attempt to kill the Pope, was part of that gang of the Wilson-Turpel gang. They intimated that this was one gang, that he was photographed with them. There are a list of subjects that I've talked about on this program for years that the Soviet Union could have put in the hands of Ronald Reagan. And the question is, why is he standing still? And I believe that the power is held because of blackmail. This week, the president announced that he would meet with Mr. Brezhnev in 1982. He can only go so far, and then he gets a letter, just as Richard Nixon can carry the anti-communist crusade through the Cold War and on the brink of the hot war. And then all of a sudden, he has to go to China, and he has to go to Russia, and he calms down because the Soviet Union has so much information on things that we have done throughout the world that they would reveal to the Allies, or the Allies already know. Another article out of the Washington Post today, a new mood of suspicion in Poland. It's by Michael Dobbs. 2 weeks after the martial law, members of the Solidarity activists who are outside of the prisons or not in jail can't figure out what happened. They said if the Russians came in, that would be different. Then we would have known that we were fighting against them. But it's our own army. We don't know how to react. And this fellow said his home is watched. He's followed. He said, for the time being, any conspiratorial work is useless since we don't know who we're against or who we conspire. One out of every five people you must assume is an informer. Well, I guess the ratio isn't any different in America than in Poland, because I've said that whenever you have an assembly of five people, not just doing things that are not political, but heavy political discussions and investigations or conferences, one out of those five is an informer. Incidentally, on the ABC News tonight, it showed a store that had been closed in Poland at the height of the martial law when they were closing things down, and the ABC camera had been there, and there's a sign in the window that said, closed for business. And somebody in the past week had called them on it, and evidently the American CIA over there don't even speak Polish, because in the Polish windows there was this English sign that somebody picked up on the news, and I thought that was pretty funny. Well, what does the Soviet Union know? For one thing, an article in the New York Times, Serge Shaman wrote, this is December 26, over 400 well-organized units, these are espionage units linked to the CIA inside Poland, and many thousands around Poland, there's 400 centers set up by East European emigres, and this links into the Galen operation we'll talk about on the second half of this program this evening. These groups are controlled by the CIA. The CIA created a crisis. They call it the control crisis. This is from the New York Times. The CIA helped found and finance an organization called KOR in 1975. The KOR worked with Western intelligence services throughout the world, and the Soviet Union has the papers to prove this. And one of their hometowns, besides Gdansk, was Katowice, the hometown of Pope John Paul II. They're right back in home territory. It was made up of dissident Polish organizations working with Western intelligence since 1975, the KOR. Then in August 1980, now in that time slot, Jimmy Carter is running for president in the fall of 1980. Whether he's in, he went along and promoted the Polish Pope, and Mr. Brzezinski, with their tentacles in Poland, Brzezinski had handpicked the Pope and Henry Kissinger, and whether Jimmy Carter won or Ronald Reagan, the operations would be set in Poland to move ahead on this Cold War escalation that the United States seems to want so badly. By August 1980, Solidarity was formed. Just as I say, before the election of Jimmy Carter. Now, the Polish-Russian affairs were managed in the CIA by George Bush, working with John Paisley, who was murdered, and Mr. Pipes, who took Paisley's place. Those were teams A and B. And Walter Stessel and Richard Allen and William Casey, the team members that I keep referring to as just too many biggies in one office shaking each other up, all in charge of Soviet and Russian affairs. Walter Stessel was ambassador to Russia and Poland and Germany. According to the New York Times article, Poland followed the U.S. citizens who came in to Poland. The CIA followed them, and evidently the Russians followed them also. And they visited and settled, and there were 10,000 Americans, evidently, who were residents in Poland in November 1981, getting ready for this crisis. You know, we talked about the missing millions of dollars in debt that has not, well, part of it was paid this evening. I understand that the Soviet Union, that's supposed to be so broke, paid a huge hunk of the interest of that debt this evening. But a lot of that money probably went, and this article intimates, brought these people into Poland to get ready for these uprisings that they thought would take place, but in fact were well under control. 10,000 American citizens there, and a lot of them were hostile to socialism. The article suggests they were agents of the CIA or U.S. intelligence getting ready for this big push. This is the end of the first 30 minutes. I'm going to take a break now and go into the Polish labor union story and the CIA. We'll take a one-minute break first.
This concludes the first half of World Watchers International with Mae Brussel. We will return with the second half after a brief pause.